coming to you from the AT&T Podcast Studio. This is Long Story Short. I'm Ted Struley, the Executive Director at Oklahoma Watch. We're a statewide nonprofit news organization that specializes in investigative reporting. You're listening to our weekly podcast, which lets you hear directly from our journalists as they provide deeper insight into their recently published stories. Heather Warlick covers evictions, homelessness, and housing for Oklahoma Watch. Heather recently wrote about how Oklahoma's restrictive zoning ordinances may stand in the way of solving the state's affordable housing shortage. Heather, what did you find in your reporting on zoning laws that surprised you?
Well, Ted, what really surprised me and inspired me to delve into the topic of zoning laws in Oklahoma is the fact that three of the state's largest cities have quite exclusionary zoning laws for residential lands. These laws are skewed largely for detached, single-family housing, excluding many other types of housing like duplexes and fourplexes, small apartment complex and such. In fact, in Oklahoma City, 96% of residentially zoned lands are specifically zoned for single-family homes. In Norman, it's 98%, and in Tulsa, it's 81% that are zoned for single family. So that means that with a few exceptions, builders are required to build only detached single family homes, generally with specific plot size minimums.
Now, you also reported on the income needed to pay for an affordable unit, an apartment or a multifamily of some kind. How many Oklahomans can't meet that threshold? What did you find out about that?
Studies are showing that in Oklahoma, a family or individual with only one full-time job needs to make at least $18 an hour to afford a modest market rate place to live. That wage comes to about $37,000 per year. And that means that about one-third of our entire working population, such as healthcare workers, childcare providers, construction workers, and many other essential employees who perform really important jobs are making less than that every year.
Now, we know home prices have gone up quite a bit since before the pandemic. How has that affected Oklahomans who have lower incomes?
You know, many homeowners vividly recall their home values hitting all-time highs during the pandemic. And that seemed like a really good thing at the time. Those prices have come down a little bit, but not enough to accommodate the workers I just mentioned. And on top of that, an influx of people moving to Oklahoma have increased the demand for housing, further driving rents and home prices up. And competition for affordable housing is really at a crisis level. For every 100 low-income families, there really are only about 49 affordable and available homes in Oklahoma. So those people who are living in homes that don't fit their budget find themselves spending as much as 50% or more of their incomes just on their housing costs.
So what are some steps regarding zoning Oklahoma cities are taking to try to solve that?
Oklahoma City and Tulsa have implemented infill overlay districts, mostly in urban core areas of the city. And that means in some areas, builders and home renovators are able to get special permissions to build homes that don't fit that single-family home mold. But this takes some doing with paperwork and hurdles to overcome with the city government. Also, Norman recently did away with its parking mandates with regard to enforcing large parking lots to accommodate businesses in the area. Whereas Norman's zoning laws previously required businesses to provide enough parking to match that business's capacity of patrons, the city now recommends how many parking spaces should be provided.
Right, and the idea is here that would open up land in the core city center that could be used for multifamily residential, right?
Right. So instead of paving paradise, as the song says, Norman is working to encourage business owners to share parking areas, which can have the effect of freeing up needed lands to use for more productive purposes, like bringing new affordable housing to areas that previously were reserved for mostly empty parking lots.
So what have other cities done that have helped create some more affordable housing?
You know, Ted, Minneapolis is a really good example of a city that has worked hard to overcome its housing crisis by rethinking their zoning ordinances. First, that city did away with single-family zoning altogether, as have several states. But when that didn't make as much of a difference as the city planners hoped for, they took additional steps to change zoning by easing parking requirements like Norman did, and by legalizing accessory dwelling units, as Oklahoma City is poised to do this year. The combination of these changes resulted in Minnesota's affordable housing units doubling between 2015 and 2020. And now more than 90% of new units built or renovated were large buildings with at least 10 units.
So give us the takeaway here from your reporting on the zoning ordinances and Oklahoma's affordable housing crisis. What did you walk away with?
Well, you may have heard of the term NIMBY, which stands for not in my backyard. And many people say they support creating more affordable housing for those in need. But when it comes to building those units in their neighborhood, they are often reluctant. They worry about their home values dropping if a big apartment complex is stationed next to their additions. A new movement of YIMBYs, or Yes in My Backyard groups, frames the benefits for loosening restrictive zoning ordinances as gateways to creating more available, affordable housing, increasing neighborhood densities, and integrating more walkable access to shopping and dining and amenities in those neighborhoods.
All right. Well, thanks, Heather. You can read all of Heather's coverage on housing, homelessness, and evictions on our website, oklahomawatch.org. Paul Moniz joins us to discuss the latest developments at the Capitol, where lawmakers are in the last month of the regular session. Paul, the budget discussions continue out there. What's the latest?
That's right. Yeah, if you remember, the big buzzword this year was transparency. And on that front, Senate President Pro Tem Greg Treat has unveiled kind of a new process that has gone on its way. And about mid-March, the Senate voted on a budget resolution, which was supposedly supposed to kick off negotiations with the House. That has not gone very well the last few weeks. And in fact, they kind of hit a standstill last week. And so Governor Stitt proposed that they all kind of come together in one room and kind of hash out some of the differences.
Well, tax cuts remain a sticking point on the budget, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, if you remember way back at the beginning of session, there was broad agreement and it actually passed. There was elimination of the state's portion of the grocery sales tax. At that time, the Senate said that that was kind of going to be the only tax cut they were going to consider. They have held firm to that position. And in the meantime, both Governor Kevin Stitt and House Speaker Charles McCall have kind of keep hitting on the need for additional tax cuts, including some quarter point reductions in the personal income tax.
Anything big come out of that budget summit?
Yeah, so they held that first big budget summit in the governor's large conference room. Everyone got around the table. You know, they're all very nice and complimentary to start out, but then it kind of devolved and kind of back to the normal sides. The sticking points that we've heard about all session with the tax cuts, differences in interpreting the numbers of the budgets and what they can and can't have. And of course, the focus is keeping some savings back as well. A lot of the lawmakers in positions of power now went through that rough 2017-2018 time period where they had to cut a lot of places they didn't want to cut. And so they remember that and kind of want that to kind of be a big part going forward too. So there's a lot of disagreements still going on. And in fact, they kind of spent about 2 hours going back and forth, have kind of pledged to come back later this week or possibly next week to kind of come back and see where they are again.
There were some changes in the people involved, right? The budget negotiators. Tell us about that.
That's right. Yeah. And a surprise move last week, the Senate Pro Tem removed his Appropriations and Budget Committee Chairman, Roger Thompson, who had been serving that position for several years, since 2019, actually. And so he's one of the longest serving budget writers up there. And in a surprise move, Treat removed him and replaced him with the vice chair of that committee, Chuck Hall. And now the new vice chair is Paul Rosino, an Oklahoma City senator. Hall's got experience on that committee. He's well-versed in some of the stuff that went on with the federal ARPA process. He was kind of in charge of that for the Senate. But it was kind of a surprise to a lot of Capitol onlookers. We're wondering what happened. Treat himself said that basically some of the negotiations with the House were not getting blessed by the subcommittees that he had put in place in the new transparency motives to efforts. And so he kind of needed a change of pace, but obviously we're less than a month out from sine die, and they need a budget. That's the one thing they need to do. So it was a little surprising move on that front.
One of the stories that came out of the Capitol recently that made a lot of headlines was the governor signing the state's immigration bill, or really anti-immigration bill, I guess would be more accurate. What did he say about it when he signed it?
That's right. Yeah, the governor has been talking about issues on the border for more than a year now, and has said that we need to do something. And in fact, has pointed to Texas example and Senate Bill 4 in Texas as one of the solutions that states can do to add kind of a state crime of, anti kind of immigration occupation for people who are here without documentation. Eventually, there was a lot of talk about that, and then Attorney General Gittner Drummond proposed it. Shortly after that, Speaker Charles McCall said he'd get some legislation going outside the normal committee structure. That went with record pace, passed with veto-proof margins in both the House and the Senate, and basically then sat on the governor's desk for the maximum amount of time. The governor was getting a lot of pressure from religious groups, including the Catholic Church, a lot of pressure from, Hispanic chambers of commerce, other folks who kind of realize that this is a very complicated issue and can't really be solved with one bill. And so he kind of let that sit there and finally signed it last week, but issued also a kind of rare signing statement that said, look, we know this needs to happen. It's a fault of the federal government that we're having to act, but basically reminding police officers and law enforcement not to target any individual types of people and groups that are out there under the law.
What other bills have you been tracking?
Yeah, so obviously there's a ton of stuff going out. The governor has signed more than 250 pieces of legislation. They all have different effective dates, but we've been tracking some of the ones with medical marijuana. He signed one to do with packaging for medical marijuana sales. He's also signed a bill that would allow the three-person corporation commission to kind of do some housekeeping stuff outside of their regular meetings, as long as they tell people what they're discussing. They've had issues with a three-person commission, two people as a quorum. So if they get together and talk about some issues, then that obviously would be a violation of the Open Meetings Act. So that bill kind of changed just the section of the law that has to do with the corporation commission to allow three-person bodies like the corporation commission to meet kind of informally and talk about kind of housekeeping issues, as long as they tell people about it after the fact. One of the caveats on that bill is they cannot talk about current rate cases that are before them. So that's off limits still in those kind of discussions. And then we've looked at kind of some other stuff with, we've had some issues with homeless encampments on state lands. The governor signed a bill that would forbid that. And so that's caused some outcry from folks who are worried about people who are unhoused as well.
What do you think happens here in the last few weeks of session? You got any predictions?
Yeah, it's kind of anybody's guess right now. I hate to put that in that box, but we'll be watching, obviously, the budget discussions going on, also looking for possible zombified bills that we thought were dead, maybe coming up in different vehicles at the last minute that people are really pushing for whatever reason. My own personal prediction is that there probably will be some type of income tax cut. It may not be as solid or as quick as either the governor or the House Speaker wants it. It may involve some triggers for future revenue. It may involve flattening some of the brackets there that the state income tax is set up under on your income levels. But I think we probably are heading down that road. But they're going to have to be quite a bit more discussions, both publicly and maybe behind the scenes, which may be not what the pro tem wants right now. But that will probably get done. I don't foresee a special session this year. I could be wrong. It's an election year. The primaries are in June. That's not too long after the sine die on May 31st. So I can't see them coming back, at least immediately, for a special session if they have unfinished business. And it's not a really good look to go to voters in an election year and say we can't really do the business what you've sent us out there to do at the Capitol in the spring session.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul. You can read all of Paul's coverage of what's going on at the Capitol during session and other issues related to state government. You'll find all that on our website, OklahomaWatch.org. Keaton Ross covers criminal justice and democracy for Oklahoma Watch. In his latest story, he reported that staff at the Lawton Correctional Center were negligent as a prisoner was brutally murdered. Keaton, what happened in the early morning hours of October 26th?
An inmate at Lawton, his name was Raymond Bailey. He was serving a sentence for second degree murder out of Oklahoma County, was murdered by a group of prisoners at Lawton. It was a pretty brutal scene. And it ultimately went undetected for several hours.
So when do ODOC officials believe Raymond Bailey was murdered?
The best estimate at this point is somewhere between 5 and 6 a.m. on the morning of October 26th. That's when closed circuit camera footage shows that there were several prisoners going in and out of Bailey's cell. At one point, someone brings a trash can into the cell, and there's different methods they use to try to conceal what's going on in there. But with the amount of activity and whatnot, that's when it's believed that the attack happened.
All right. So sometime between 5 and 6 in the morning. And then when was his body discovered?
Staff didn't find his body until 9:57 a.m., so around 4 hours after, or more than 4 hours after that estimate, and his body was found in a trash can at the entrance of the housing unit covered with milk cartons. So it was a pretty rough scene there.
You mentioned at the top that there was some negligence involved here, right? But nobody's been charged yet. So how do we know that prison staff were negligent in this instance?
So I mentioned that camera footage that showed prisoners going in and out of Bailey's cell when that attack is believed to have happened. Footage also shows staff walking by, but not doing their required cell counts. There's a policy that staff are supposed to go by the cells at night and shine a flashlight and do a count and basically make sure that everyone is where they're supposed to be, and that a DOC internal investigation found that staff were neglecting those counts, that if they were doing them properly would have shown that something was going on in Bailey's cell that was not supposed to be happening.
Now, if prisoners are locked in their cells at night, why would it be important for staff to do these counts in the middle of the night?
So in some cases, you'll have prisoners that have improvised devices or methods to break out of their cell at night for various reasons. You have an instance like this where someone's being targeted for an attack for whatever reason. It could be debt. It could be something else. But there are ways that even if they're locked in the cell at night, they can sort of manipulate the locks and break out in certain cases.
Now, did the Department of Corrections investigators recommend criminal charges for any of the staff that were on duty?
Not for the staff. The staff were terminated pretty soon after this incident. They found that the negligence and not doing the cell checks and that sort of thing, they were cited for that, as well as they found a large shank on one of the prisoners that the DOC investigators determined that if they were doing adequate checks for contraband, that they should have uncovered that. So they were ultimately terminated, but criminal charges were not recommended for the staff that were on duty.
All right. What about the prisoners who committed the murder? Any recommended charges there?
Yes, there are 4 inmates who the DOC internal investigator recommended be charged with second degree murder and possession of contraband. That investigation has been forwarded to the Comanche County District Attorney's Office. But charges have yet to be filed, so we'll be keeping an eye out for that.
Now, state prison officials have floated the idea of taking over the Lawton Prison. That is the last remaining privately run prison in the state. Is that a possibility in the near future? Didn't they have a contract coming up?
That likely not in the near future. The Department of Corrections spokesperson told me that they have renewed that contract. It was set to expire on July 31st of this year. So that contract is up for through at least 2025. I believe it's a 4 or 5 year contract, and there are annual points where the state can look to terminate that contract. But sort of with the logistics of the amount of people at the Lawton Prison, it's the state's, not only the state's only private prison, but also the state's largest prison. Houses about 2,600 men. So a pretty big chunk of Oklahoma's prison population is there. And the logistics of getting enough staff to state staff to work at the facility would be challenging on a quick basis is sort of how it was explained to me from the Department of Corrections. So likely not in the near future.
All right. Well, thanks, Keaton. You can read Keaton's story about the murder at the Lawton Correctional Center, as well as all his work on criminal justice and democracy. You'll find it at our website, oklahomawatch.org. While you're there, you'll want to sign up for Keaton's weekly newsletter, Democracy Watch. You've been listening to Long Story Short, a weekly podcast that helps you get deeper into the investigative stories reported by Oklahoma Watch, which you can find on the web at oklahomawatch.org. This episode was recorded at the AT&T Podcast Studio. For Oklahoma Watch, I'm Ted Strooley. Thanks for listening.